the indentured American household? Concern about Americans becoming indentured servants or sharecroppers laboring on behalf of whip-holding creditors, credit card companies in the United States, dollar-holding central bankers in Asia, became a marginal political issue in 2005, struggling for attention but not getting much. The analogy did not strike a popular chord. Indentured servitude had been allowed in the 13 colonies of 1775 under British law, and it was not forbidden after the Revolution by the new American Republic. The practice had been reinforced by imprisonment, re-indenturing, and other penalties. Nevertheless, by 1800, it had largely withered. In the spirit of the Declaration of Independence, indenturing became unacceptable, at least for whites. 200 years later, personal bankruptcy filings under Chapters 7 and 13 of the Federal Bankruptcy Code during the first Bush administration totaled close to 5 million, a record for a single White House term. Household pressures were becoming acute. In 2005, Congress passed and the President signed new federal bankruptcy legislation promoted by a worried credit card industry. It required would-be bankrupts with incomes above a certain level to accept a new status under Chapter 13. Instead of having their debts discharged, they would keep paying determined credit card charges, medical bills, and other obligations. Proponents made the valid point that many filers shouldn't be allowed to use the permissive Chapter 7 procedures to simply walk away from their debts. Opponents countered that the new procedures were extreme and could lend themselves to harsh implementation. Some of the angriest foes, including House Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi and Massachusetts Senator Edward Kennedy, likened the future status of bankrupts to modern-day indentured servants. Few in the media took the interpretive bait. The analogy is premature until we see how bankruptcy procedures under the 2005 Act play out over a number of years. However, the debilitation of wage earners is clear enough. Over the last four decades, as manufacturing employment has tumbled and finance has gained, wages have declined sharply as a share of personal income. Borrowing and spending as a percentage of wages, in turn, have both soared. For not quite half of the population, what some Democrats would picture as involuntary servitude can be summed up thus. The number of good jobs shrinks, wages decline, consumer appetites remain constant or intensify, credit cards are pitched endlessly and misleadingly, the credulous sign up and cards are issued. Rates and charges eventually change, pain begins, and on go the plastic shackles. Because of the unusual harness yoking the American consumer to the world economy, a vague public sense of being used, dry political tinder of the first order, could develop. We have seen that the 1990s credit card takeoff had several stages. It began, said Robert Manning, author of Credit Card Nation, in 1997 when credit card issuers targeted young people and pursued them relentlessly. Consumer historian Peter Stearns described the national mindset before September 11th. For many people, particularly in the United States, the commitment to consumerism introduced a new precariousness to material life. By 2001, despite unprecedentedly high incomes, over half of all Americans had almost no savings, and a third lived paycheck to paycheck, often in considerable consumer debt. In some cases, this situation reflected continued real poverty, but in others, it followed from a sense that so many goods and trips had become absolutely essential. A new stage came after September 11th, when spending as patriotism combined with economic apprehension and the lowest interest rates in 40 years to promote home refinancing and debt consolidation. Both usually provided spendable cash or mortgage payment savings and stimulated a weak economy. The downside was that between the presidential elections of 2000 and 2004, household debt grew by 39%. Real disposable income, however, showed very little growth. In 2005, macroeconomist Stephanie Pomboy explained that over the three previous years, consumers had leaned more heavily on new borrowing, $675 billion of non-mortgage debt, then on paychecks, up only $530 billion to make possible the overall $1.3 trillion increase in their spending. The period after September 11th also saw a stepped-up Washington bias in favor of the credit card industry, especially on the part of the Bush administration. For credit card firms, the ability to borrow at 1-2% facilitated their ability to offer new cardholders sweet enrollment deals and often the chance to consolidate their debt in one place at seemingly great savings. However, once the new enrollee was hooked, the card companies were free to raise rates on just about any pretext, often from 6 or 11% into the 20-30% range, and to take advantage of the deregulation of fees authorized by the 1996 Smiley decision. Little or no attempt was made by the White House to rein in the card issuers with an appeal to wartime patriotism, unlike that made to consumers to spend patriotically and shared sacrifice. On the contrary, profiteering flourished. To call the fees lucrative is an understatement. Between 2000 and 2004, lateness and over-the-borrowing limit penalties ballooned, and overall credit card profits soared. According to CBS News, the portion of credit card issuer profits represented by fees jumped from 28% in 2000 to 33% in 2002, 35% in 2003, and an estimated 39% in 2004. The hidden costs of credit to consumers rode an up escalator even as the actual borrowing costs of the corporate issuers declined.